Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we are kicking off a two-part series on this country's homeless crisis. Today, we will discuss California. Tomorrow, we'll look at what's working across the country. California is home to a record 189 billionaires and home to more homeless people than any other state. Over 160,000 of California's residents experience homelessness on any given day. This is according to official numbers from the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness. But advocates say that number is likely much higher. In recent years, state and local officials have pledged billions to address this crisis, but progress is slow and at times elusive. California Governor Gavin Newsom's January budget calls for $2 billion to expand access to housing for vulnerable populations and people living in encampments. That is on top of $12 billion devoted to the crisis in the last budget. According to a recent state audit, California has an uncoordinated approach when it comes to this issue, and that has hampered the effectiveness of its efforts. So today we're going to talk about the factors that have contributed to this crisis, what is working, and what needs to change. Joining us are three guests. Jackie Botts is a reporter with CalMatters who has written extensively on this crisis. Jackie Botts covers income inequality and economic survival for the California Divide and was awarded a Pulitzer Prize in explanatory reporting in 2021. Hi, Jackie. Thanks so much for joining us.
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you.
Great to have you. Tomika Moss is founder and CEO of All Home, an organization dedicated to finding regional solutions to the homeless and housing crisis in the Bay Area. Prior to establishing All Homes, Tomika Moss served as CEO of Hamilton Families, a San Francisco organization offering emergency, transitional, and permanent housing services for families experiencing homelessness. Hi, Tomika. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Carolina Reed is associate professor in the UC Berkeley Department of City and Regional Planning and the faculty research advisor for the Turner Center for Housing Innovation. Hi, Carolina. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Well, we're looking forward to it as well. We're going to do a number of shows throughout the year. And if we could just start with some basic points. Jackie, you and your colleagues wrote a really good piece, just really looking at, you know, who is homeless, where did they live before, how many are military families, a major cause of homelessness is rent. What about survivors of domestic violence, formerly incarcerated people? And I thought this did such a good job because the conversation around this issue, you know, it can be really heated and we really need time to go over this. And so I'm so glad we have you all for the hour. As you point out in the piece, Jackie, a person experiencing homelessness in California is about twice as likely to be male than female and significantly more likely to be LGBTQ than in the population at large. And then a growing proportion are seniors. New research indicates that nearly half of seniors on the street fall into homelessness after the age of 50. So when you looked at just basic research, what else stood out for you, Jackie?
Yeah, thanks for the question. There, I think, are a lot of data points that we see that can actually bust some myths about homelessness. We often see in a common image or understanding of who is homeless is people who are living on the street in tents and who maybe seem like they're not sharing the same reality with you, or people who have been there for a very long time. In fact, only about a third of Californians experiencing homelessness are people who are considered chronically homeless. So that means that they've been living consistently without shelter for a year or a cumulative year over the past 3 years and have a disability. And many more people are experiencing a form of homelessness, which is much more transient and might last for several weeks or months. homelessness is not just people living in encampments. It's also people living in cars and shelters, or even couch surfing or staying with family temporarily. Data also shows that there are huge racial imbalances in California. Roughly 30% of the state's unhoused population is Black, compared with less than 7% of the state's population being Black. And this has everything to do with a legacy of racial discrimination in the United States and in California around housing policy, access to jobs. You know, our entire American history of slavery is behind that as well. And then, you know, the other data points that I thought would be interesting to bring up have to do with mental health and behavioral health issues. So there have been different data points, and they vary, but let's see, I'm pulling this up. The Los Angeles Times did research into California's, or I guess it was Los Angeles County's, residents living on the streets. And they found that about 2/3 were suffering from a psychological or substance abuse disorder, or both. Other research has found lower rates. The California Policy Lab found that about 20%. But it just goes to show that there's a wide range of reasons and profiles of people experiencing homelessness in California.
Exactly. And it's also important to point out that everyone has a story. I mean, you have an incredible story about Fernando Maya, a 56-year-old, and the piece is called One Man's Lonely Journey Through California's Plan to End Homelessness. It's really an incredible piece. The thing that's amazing about it, Jackie, is you could write a piece like this about everyone who's living on the streets right now.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, each person's experience, the reasons that they became homeless, the reason that they stayed homeless, the reasons that they may be able to leave homelessness are incredibly unique. And at the same time, there are also a lot of patterns. And when I spoke to experts and frontline staff who work with people experiencing homelessness, they also pointed out ways in which Fernando Maya's experience, both of chronic homelessness and then his experience of transitioning into permanent supportive housing, which was really the subject of my article, are in many ways common as well.
Another data point that is, I think, is so important, and Tamika, Jackie and her colleagues point this out in the piece, one of the more enduring myths about California's homeless population is that the vast majority have traveled here from other states to, quote, seek generous government assistance. But data shows, and this is data provided by 42 of the 44 local agencies that manage homeless dollars, 96% of people who access homeless services did so in a single jurisdiction. Homelessness within California is not a problem of migration. That's just, again, one other data point. Tamika, what other points do you want to add when we're talking about, you know, such a huge issue here?
Yeah, I think that's such a great statistic, because people don't actually believe you when you tell them that the data confirms that folks become homeless in the communities where they're from. And that's also, I think, one of the challenges, is that if we are only trying to address this crisis city by city, county by county, we're not going to be able to have the resources and strategies that can scale and deal with the crisis that we're experiencing. And so that's why my organization, All Home, has really tried to take a regional approach. So we work across all 9 counties in the Bay Area, trying to lift up best practices. How do we share resources? How do we use data to inform what strategies and priorities we take on in order to address our unhoused crisis, as Jackie was talking about, but also the million or so people who have extremely low incomes in our region and are just one emergency away from experiencing homelessness. I think one of the challenges that we face, having been a practitioner, for every family that I housed when I worked at Hamilton, 3 more families would become homeless during the same period of time. Mm. And it's important for us to recognize that the inflow, the number of people who are falling into homelessness, is growing faster than the number of people we can house. And I think those conditions are informed by the cost of housing. We know everybody who is listening, everybody who lives and works and plays in the Bay Area and the state of California knows that we do not have enough housing that is affordable to people, frankly, with high incomes, let alone with people who are earning less than $35,000 a year, which is that extremely low income category that we are paying attention to. And so when you have a shortage of housing supply that we've amassed over many decades, you have incomes that have stayed flat or reduced, certainly during the pandemic. And then the legacy, I think Jackie was talking about, is structural racism, which is borne out in who, in fact, is experiencing this crisis. That trifecta is why we have so many folks experiencing homelessness in our state. And I think we have to think about how do we tackle those challenges in concert with one another. And I think that's some of the work we've been paying attention to, is you can't just make individual investments in any one strategy. Mm-hmm. You have to do a sort of multi-pronged approach in order to tackle this challenge. And those are some of the things we've been exploring here in the Bay Area.
Yeah, you brought up so many important statistics there. And again, luckily, we have time to really dive into them. To piggyback on what Tomika said, Carolina, it was so interesting to read this state audit. In February, the California State Auditor looked at five local governments that play a key role in a continuum of care. This is basically local governments and homeless service providers that receive funding from HUD. They looked at Mendocino, Riverside, Fresno, Santa Barbara, and Santa Clara counties, and they found that these counties really struggle to coordinate efforts to address homelessness. And therefore, we just don't know what's working. We don't know what needs to change. So can you talk about why that is the case? And what will it do to change? What will it take to change that?
Yes, thank you so much. I think the first thing to recognize is that we do know what works in addressing homelessness, and there are a lot of really innovative and important initiatives that are taking place in California, in local jurisdictions. So I think the narrative of like, this isn't working, we need to stop that narrative too, because I do think that everything from the state dedicating unprecedented resources to this problem to local organizations really innovating, even in the midst of the COVID pandemic, we do have good solutions. I think the problem of coordination is that homelessness is such a complex problem that you actually need to address it from every single system and at every single level. Everything from housing and building more housing to providing mental health services to providing job training, right? There's such a spectrum of interventions that are needed. And those systems have not historically worked very well together. And so groups like All Home are trying to think about how do we re-knit those systems so that they do work better. I think the other really important piece of this is that we have for too long thought of homelessness as an individual problem as opposed to a structural problem. And in California, it is definitely aligned with structural racism nationally as well, but also, and you started the program with this, the rising income inequality in our state, right? It is as much tied to the fact that we have this really large group of very high income earners who are putting pressure on the housing market and making housing increasingly unaffordable for lower income households. I'll stop there. I have a lot more to say about the coordination of care, but I'll kick it back to you.
Yeah, and I think that the hard part about this is, you know, I was looking on Twitter the other night. Some people in the Bay Area have Twitter accounts where they basically just post photos of people living on the street, someone with their pants down, you know, human feces on the sidewalk. And it becomes this kind of enraged conversation, and a lot of the facts are missing. The substance of what we're talking about is missing. I mean, I understand people are angry about this, but What will it take, do you think, Tomika, to really have a conversation about this issue that is based on facts and really brings in the systemic issues that Carolina just mentioned?
You know, Rose, I think that that's the hardest part of shifting the conversation and taking action. You know, we put together what we call a regional action plan. It was a cross-sectorial group of folks, business leaders, folks with lived experience, mayors, county supervisors, city council members, community-based organization leaders. And we came up with a regional plan to reduce unsheltered homelessness by 75% over the next 3 years across the 9-county Bay Area. And the reason that the coalition set such an audacious goal is because our brothers and sisters are literally dying on our streets. And we have to have an urgent and rapid response in order to bring people indoors so that they can begin to heal and be on the journey toward permanent housing. And so I think it is human to feel emotion about seeing the degradation of our fellow residents and people on our streets. And we have to have a sense of urgency about that. But as I said, if that is just the tip of the iceberg, the people that we see in our encampments and those experiencing this crisis who are unsheltered is just the tip of the iceberg, because just behind them are folks who are just on the cusp of falling into homelessness. And that's why we, as a part of this plan, lift up interim housing, which means non-congregate shelter settings, voucher, whatever it takes to bring people indoors quickly. We also focus on homelessness prevention. We actually need to figure out how to prevent people from falling into homelessness in the first place, providing legal services, providing financial assistance, and housing navigation services to ensure that people who have had that economic emergency are not falling into homelessness in the first place. And then the third part of that strategy is permanent housing. Caroline and I have, and Jackie knows this as well, we do not have enough housing that is deeply affordable. Not everyone needs wraparound service-enriched housing and subsidy for the rest of their lives. A lot of people just need really deeply affordable housing that their incomes can afford. So we believe if we invest in interim housing, prevention, and permanent housing concurrently, that's when we will be able to see a demonstrative impact of people coming inside and working toward permanent housing in our communities. So we feel like we have to make policy decisions, resource decisions that support the things that are working and scale them.
And Jackie, can you talk about the role that inequality plays in all of this and elaborate on that? According to the numbers that you all put out, here's just one example. 70% of San Francisco's homeless people were housed somewhere in the city when they lost their housing. I mean, and we know that rents are just astronomical. Also, the California Policy Lab in 2020 found that 74% of people experiencing homelessness previously worked in California. 47% were found to have worked within 4 years of becoming homeless. And the fact is, a lot of people are still making minimum wage, and it's really hard to make ends meet on minimum wage in a state like California. So can you talk about inequality, Jackie, and how that contributes to this crisis?
Yes, thank you. I mean, as we all know, we live in the state, California. You can walk down so many streets in California and just see inequality. So many people are living in this, incredible divide. And I think a lot of it has to do with what Tomika already mentioned, is the fact that even as wealth has been consolidated and been growing quite quickly for many of kind of the most elite, highest earning members of our society, low incomes and minimum wages have just absolutely stagnated over the past decades. And meanwhile, the cost of living in California has skyrocketed. And that has to do with housing, first and foremost, and also many of the other products that we buy just to survive. I think that it's also important to recognize that California, in many ways, is policy-wise one of the most progressive states in terms of redistributing income through our progressive tax system. We do have, we were the trendsetter in setting a $15 minimum wage, and we have many programs in place that are not available in many parts of the country, and yet we're still one of the states with the highest rates of inequality. And when you take into account the cost of living in California, we consistently top the charts for the highest poverty rates.
We have a comment from a listener who says, I know you're talking about California, but here in Colorado, King Soopers workers are on strike. One of the points they made is that they are full-time employees and some of them are homeless. And this study just came out recently, and we're going to talk more about the rest of the country tomorrow, but it is so important to point out that even people who are working are homeless because they cannot find housing. Before we go to a break, I just wanted to highlight one of the stats you brought to the show, which I think is so important to Mika, and this one deserves to be repeated. For every person who gets housed, who finds housing, another three become homeless. San Francisco officials say for every homeless person they house, another three fall into homelessness. The Los Angeles Housing Services Authority said that it was able to place more than 20,000 people experiencing homelessness into housing in 2019, but the homeless population still grew by 13% because three more people fell into homelessness. This deserves so much more attention, Tomika.
Agreed. And I think it's hard for the general public to really understand that there is so much good work happening to rehouse people, to figure out how to increase the household incomes, get people connected to jobs and skill development in order to sustain that housing stability. But I think that's why folks trying to understand the structural nature of this challenge beyond what you see in front of you is so critical. Another statistic, Rose, that I often share is when I was working at Hamilton, more than 40% of the families that we were experiencing homelessness had jobs. Some of them had two jobs, and they were still experiencing homelessness. So what the caller identified is absolutely part of what we have seen here in San Francisco and in the Bay Area. And so unless we not only figure out our housing affordability crisis, we must also look at our economic stability strategies and pair those together so that those who are just on the brink, as I said, and I think COVID revealed this more than anything, when so many folks lost their jobs to COVID, our essential workers and frontline workers were still going to work sick. Those folks needing financial assistance to stay in their housing, that rental assistance that we saw the federal government provide across the country and subsequently California establishing the rental assistance program, those dollars are critical to try to reduce that inflow into homelessness that we see, and also avoiding that eviction cliff. A lot of the protections around evictions through the most recent state initiatives is coupled with resources so that we can make sure tenants have protection so they're not going to be evicted because of non-payment of rent. And we have the financial and legal services to keep people housed in the first place.
This is so important. And just quickly before we go to break, Jackie, to Tomika's point, in one of your pieces, you write, advocates worry more rental aid won't come before March, when most cities are set to allow landlords to resume evictions for non-payment of rent. And Jonathan Russell of Bay Area Community Services said, we will very likely see the impact on homelessness slowly grow and accrue in coming months and years as a result of this. Can you talk about that, Jackie, just briefly?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that throughout the pandemic, there has been sort of this holding of our breaths to see what happens when the relief and the protections dry up. And so that kind of eviction cliff that Tamika mentioned has been perpetually pushed off. And there's research to show that much of the aid that has been distributed has been incredibly helpful in stabilizing people and keeping people from falling into homelessness. But we're still not in a post-pandemic world. There still is access to these programs. And what will be very important is that there's a way for these programs to continue to be available for people as we move out of emergency response and people are finding themselves trying to, you know, rebuild their lives in a post-pandemic world. There's a lot that it continues to be yet to seen about what the long-term impact of homelessness or of COVID has been on homelessness. And there's also just a lack of data at this point when it comes to actually the number of people who are homeless. The federal government mandates that communities do counts of homelessness each year. And these counts are well known to be flawed. They're undercounts. They're volunteers who survey the community and just try to count individual people who are experiencing homelessness out on the streets or living in shelters. However, these have in many places been canceled during the pandemic, both last year and this year. And so there's a lot we don't know about what COVID has done to the rates of homelessness in California.
Right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. That is Jackie Botts, a reporter with CalMatters, who has written extensively on homelessness. Tamika Moss is founder and CEO of All Home, an organization dedicated to finding regional solutions to the homeless crisis in the Bay Area. Carolina Reed is associate professor in the UC Berkeley Department of City and Regional Planning and faculty research advisor for the Turner Center for Housing Innovation. On today's Your Call, we are kicking off a two-part series on this country's homeless crisis by discussing what is working and what needs to change in the state of California. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about the homeless crisis in California. Tomorrow, we will talk about what is working across the country. Today, we're joined by Jackie Botts, a reporter with CalMatters, Tamika Moss, founder and CEO of All Home, and Carolina Reed, faculty research advisor for the Turner Center for Housing Innovation. If you have any questions or comments about the homeless crisis in California, we'd love to hear from you. If you work in this, on these issues, and you'd like to talk about solutions that you have seen, give us a call, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We talked a little bit, Carolina, about some of the solutions that are working. And going back to the statistic about, you know, for every person who is housed, another three become homeless. Can you just tell us what is happening in the state when it comes to actually housing people? And then we can talk about the challenges involved in building more affordable housing.
Yeah, of course. I would say first that the point that Tamika made about people falling into homelessness. We estimate that in California, there are about 1.2 million households that are at risk. They are extremely low income and they basically can't afford their housing costs. The single most important solution is actually providing a housing subsidy. And unfortunately, in the United States, housing has never been considered a human right. And so we don't have nearly as much subsidy provided by the federal government as we have families that need that kind of money. And so you have a large number of households that are earning less than $35,000 that really can only afford, and many of them are earning $17,000, $18,000, or they're on Social Security and low-income seniors. And their housing costs, particularly when they see rent increases, just become unsustainable. The first solution, and unfortunately with Build Back Better, we see some of that motivation to expand access to housing assistance sort of waning. But the single most important thing we could do is provide housing assistance to more families. The second piece that is critical is that we need to expand the number of housing units that are available at lower costs to extremely low and low-income families. And I think there the state has been trying to make significant interventions. The state's Home Key program, which facilitates the conversion of hotels and motels and other buildings into permanent supportive housing, is a really great step. Other initiatives to try and expand the amount of affordable housing is really important. But despite how progressive California likes to think it is, we also find that communities continually resist this housing, and that is a core part of the problem.
Right. And then to go to the high cost, a recent estimate from the LA City Auditor, Los Angeles, put the median cost of building one unit at more than $530,000. A new project coming online in San Jose is estimated at about $470,000 per unit. And can you talk a little bit about the money that Governor Newsom is setting aside to build affordable housing? How is that going to be rolled out? What is the time frame on that?
So some of the programs are rolling out now. I will say that across the board, California has been trying to meet this crisis with the sort of urgency and the resources it deserves. It's not enough, right? We have underinvested in housing for so many decades. It's going to be hard to sort of make up the gap. But for example, the Home Key program, the second round is currently being allocated now. It's not a panacea. There are still challenges, again, largely around the lack of additional subsidies and housing assistance coming from the federal government. We're seeing units come online. It's just that without that coordination that you were talking about earlier, and expanded resources and a focus on not just people who are experiencing homelessness, but all the people who are insecurely housed, who are at risk of eviction, all of the things that Tamika and Jackie were talking about, it's going to be hard to solve this crisis in a short period of time.
Right. Well, let's hear from a caller who'd like to talk about their personal experience. Let's go to Tina in Oakland. Hi, Tina. Welcome to the show.
Hello?
Hi. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. My brother suffers paranoid schizophrenia. He was homeless for almost a decade, and I had to chase him down to find out what was going on with him, because what he would do is that he would take up an address and take a mailbox with that address, and he would accept mail there. And so we didn't know where he was for years. And this was in Chico. Now, and he's now housed because we were able to get him a house before the housing prices rose. And it's devastating me economically, because I'm taking care of another adult who can't take care of himself. Mm. So I just want to address a couple of the things that are being mentioned here and some of the myths over my 10 years of experiencing it with him, and also in the Bay Area of having 3 no-fault evictions myself in the last year.
Oh, wow.
It's when people start pointing the finger at my neighbors call them ne'er-do-wells. they're missing key points of, one, exactly what you keep repeating, which is housing first. It absolutely has to happen, and it absolutely has to be affordable housing. There are no affordable apartments anymore. They keep building condos because there is a if you have the same amount of property for a condo, you're getting 100, say you're getting 100 residents, you're going to get one property tax from one landlord. If it's apartments, you're going to get 100 property taxes off of $500,000 to $1 million units from 100 different people. You follow me on that?
Yeah.
So that's why they're building all these luxury condos, because it's sort of it's saving, it doesn't say that they can raise taxes on people, you know, so they can get reelected. They can say, oh, well, we built this housing, and then it sits empty because nobody can afford it.
Well, Tina, you brought up so many points, and we're definitely, first off, we're going to do a three-part series on mental health issues, because this is just such an incredible crisis under COVID, but even before COVID, it was a crisis. And then you're talking about the housing. I mean, I grew up in Petaluma, and I'm shocked at the cost in a place like Petaluma, new apartment buildings. And then you bring the issue up of just the personal issues that we're all dealing with, caregiving in your case, and then having to get an eviction notice at the same time. I mean, that is a lot to deal with.
I have a master's degree working as a teacher. My partner is working as a musician. We both had rent control and both got no-fault eviction. And without the rent control, there is no way we would have been able to live in San Francisco. We now live in West Oakland because he was smart enough to purchase a place that was that would have been a teardown and rehab it. And so the money that he saved, he was able to do that. But now it's like, and then my place, they just sort of, the owner moved in. Her daughter just decided to move in, but she took up what used to house six people for she and her husband.
Tina, thank you so much for calling. Tamika, I think Tina's speaking to something so important. You've got her brother who has what sounds like a pretty severe mental illness, and then Tina and her husband are working, and yet they're living on the edge, receiving eviction notices. And, you know, this happens regularly in the Bay Area.
And Tina, I so appreciate you sharing your story, because it's such a reflection. I think Jackie was talking about the common trends. These types of experiences that Tina shared, as you said, is happening everywhere. In the city of Oakland, where I live, between 2017 and 2019, we saw a 42% increase in homelessness. And that was directly tied to the increase of housing that community experienced in that time period. And of those folks, of the folks experiencing homelessness in the city of Oakland, 70% are African American. And so when you think about like how quickly we are seeing this crisis escalate and what happens when you don't have sufficient housing, but also the mental health and supports that are accessible when people need them, that we have not, we have disinvested in mental health services nationwide since the 80s when Reagan began to close down all of the psychiatric hospitals and disinvest in mental health supports within our communities. And so it's not a surprise to me that all of these things are colliding. And when people are like, why can't they just get housing? And why can't they just, that individual blaming and othering that is going on prevents us from taking a hard look at the structural deficits that exist within systems across across the spectrum. We know that folks who have been incarcerated are much more likely to experience homelessness. Young people who have been in the foster care system, there are incredible organizations like Larkin Street who are focusing on LGBTQ youth who are experiencing this. So it's a monolith. We treat homelessness as if it's monolithic, but in fact, it's so diverse. And we have to be able to apply a wide range of strategies and considerations if we're going to get anywhere.
And to add one more to your important list, we just got an email from Matt. Homelessness came my way after being diagnosed with cancer because of caps on Social Security, disability, and medical for $35,000. You lose your benefits if you earn more than that cap, and then this creates an insane domino effect. This is another important point, Tamika. I mean, you're getting these benefits because you can't make ends meet, but then when you get a job that pays a little bit more, you're going to lose your safety net.
We actually have a word for that, Rose. It's called the benefits cliff. Hmm. And our organization and working with Caroline at the Turner Center, we have looked at what triggers benefits when you earn more money and you are pursuing CalWORKs or you're on Social Security and then your food stamps get cut off. I mean, these are things that perpetuate poverty in our society, and in fact disincentivize folks who would otherwise want to use some of their Social Security dollars toward housing to preserve those because they don't want their other benefits affected. We've got to figure out again how to unpack some of these compounding structural failures if we're going to make a real difference in people's lives.
Right. Hey, Carolina, we should do an entire show on that because a lot of our listeners are living on Social Security. For some people, that's $700, $800, $900 a month. What will it take to change that specifically with these caps that Matt and so many others are having to deal with?
I think mostly it takes political will, right? And I do think we spend a lot of money on housing. We just spend it and even on other kinds of asset building or sort of wealth building generation policies. Most of that money goes to higher income families. So if we look at the federal budget, most of the spending on things that can help people thrive economically goes to families making more than $200,000. And so it really is a political will to shift resources to those households that need those resources the most to stabilize and thrive.
Jackie, before we end, I just want to take a little bit of time to talk about your incredible piece, One Man's Lonely Journey Through California's Plan to End Homelessness. You spent a lot of time with 56-year-old Fernando Maya and his journey. You learned about his background, his childhood. Can you just tell us what really stood out for you? In summary, the pandemic gave a chronically homeless veteran in LA a chance at permanent supportive housing, but his experience differed from what state leaders envision. So just give us a synopsis of what you learned about Fernando.
Yeah, sure. Fernando is actually 58 years old right now. I first met him when he was 56. So it's been 2 years and a few months that I've been following his journey. When I first met him, he was living on a sidewalk in Los Angeles, had been for a while. But he had cycled in and out of chronic homelessness for about 3 decades. He is a Navy veteran who first tried crack cocaine while he was in the Navy and found himself dependent on the drug by the time that he left the Navy and cycled in and out of rehabilitation programs, housing programs that required him to stay sober, which he struggled to do. He was in and out of jail and prison for many years up until around 2010. And then over the last decade, he lived for a while paying month to month in a hotel before he went back to living outside and was living outside for several years when the pandemic hit. The pandemic gave him this sort of very fast exit route out of homelessness in the form of Project Room Key, which was California's program to rapidly house elderly and vulnerable unhoused people in individual shelters, which were hotel rooms and hotels that were basically vacated by the pandemic. And he was in a Project Room Key hotel room for 5 months, which gave him, in his view, the stability he needed to finally successfully apply for a housing subsidy voucher through VASH, which is a veterans, chronically homeless veterans program that also came with a studio apartment in a building that has units specifically set aside for people recovering from chronic homelessness, veterans and people with mental illness. And so he's now been in that unit for about 14 months. And my story chronicled the kind of many ups and downs that he's had along the way, and the ways that the permanent supportive housing program that he was in, while it has tried to sort of provide him with the resources that he would need to move towards many of his own goals, which include trying to get a job and trying to reconnect with family, there's been a mismatch. There's been a lot of turnover in staff. He's struggled to build the trust he needs. He struggled with his own mental health and with his substance use, and has found the transition to be much more challenging, really, than he ever expected.
How is he doing today? You have some, I hope that people can take the time to look at the photos and the texts that you exchanged. But how did, I also wondered, how did he respond to your piece? And then how is he doing today?
Yeah. Last time I spoke with him was actually Friday. I reviewed the entire piece with him. So that was a few days before it actually published. His response was, good story. You know, I think for him, there was some amount of relief in having this chance to just put out his whole story out into the world. And I think that there's also an element of this reporting process for him, which was that I was someone who over the course of 2 years was regularly calling him and checking in to see how he was doing and just chatting and having conversations, texting back and forth. And he actually hasn't really had anyone else in the homeless services providers of Los Angeles who was around that long in a job or assigned to him for that long to talk to him. Right. And so the reporting process, I think for him, actually provided a bit of stability and opportunity to reflect and to share about what was going on, what he was struggling with, what his goals were. He today is still housed and he is actually kind of on a more positive period right now. He had been struggling a lot with feeling unsafe in the building that he has been living in, and more recently has been finding himself feeling more safe and thus more independent, more able to do what he wants to do.
Wow. To think about just basic safety, that everyone has a right to actually feel safe in a home, and that so many don't. Again, you can find this piece, Jackie Bott's piece, One Man's Lonely Journey Through California's Plan to End Homelessness. It's at yourcallradio.org. Again, I say this lately a lot. I wish we had another hour, because we're getting so many incredible emails and personal experiences. Tomika, a lot of people are talking about venture capital groups and investors buying up housing, which we're definitely going to do a show about that. The other question people are asking is just, at this point, solutions. If you could change things, what are some of the things you would change at the top of your list?
Well, I think the very first solution is say yes to housing. Carolina talked about this earlier. We still have community members, even in our progressive communities across the state, who oppose housing developments in their communities. Say yes to housing. Go to your city council meetings. Talk to your neighbors. The primary solution to homelessness is housing. And so that is the very first thing you can do. I think the second thing is to really understand the connection of what a person is experiencing, whether or not it's Fernando's story or anyone else you know, and the connection to the structures that continue to perpetuate this crisis for so many other people behind them. We have to take a systematic approach to addressing this issue if we're going to make a real difference. And then the last thing is just to have compassion, that our neighbors are in need of support from every single one of us, from the person that they meet on the street to a business leader who is impacting the economy because their workers are in housing that is no longer affordable to low-income residents. Everyone has a role to play, Rose, in the solution. And I just encourage people to embrace their role with empathy and compassion and get engaged. Figure out a way that you can tackle this issue in your community.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. What would you add, Carolina?
I think Tamika said it beautifully. Say yes to housing, say yes to compassion, and recognize that we are all part of the system. And so thinking about sort of your own personal approach to, you know, treating people that you see living on the street with humanity. They are people who, deserve respect and honor and compassion.
Thank you so much. Carolina Reed is Associate Professor in the UC Berkeley Department of City and Regional Planning and Faculty Research Advisor for the Turner Center for Housing Innovation. Carolina, thank you for your work. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tamika Moss is founder and CEO of All Home, an organization dedicated to finding regional solutions to the homeless and housing crisis in the Bay Area. Tamika, thank you and your team for all of your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Jackie Botts is a reporter with Cal Matters who has written extensively on homelessness, and you can find her piece about Fernando Maya, One Man's Lonely Journey Through California's Plan to End Homelessness. Jackie, great reporting. Thank you for taking the time to join us.
Thank you, Russ.
Thank you. And coming up tomorrow, we will continue talking about the homeless crisis by discussing policies that work across the country and how they can be replicated. We'll also find out how communities and governments are addressing the growing crisis of older people living on the streets of the wealthiest country in the world. Thanks to Chris Nooney for producing today's show. Thanks to David Latulippe for engineering the show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.